to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. I've been out and about covering the 2017 Cinequest Film Festival in Silicon Valley, and this week I'm featuring guests from the film What Happened in Vegas, a shocking and heartbreaking documentary about three murder cases where the victims were shot by the police. The film reveals a police department seemingly willing to go to any lengths to protect its image and hide its crimes. The film also features good cops trying to act with integrity within a broken system and considers what has gone wrong and how it might be fixed. First, I spoke to filmmaker Ramsey Dennison. So I'm here at Cinequest with Ramsey Dennison, who is the director, producer and editor on the film What Happened in Vegas, which has had its world premiere here at Cinequest. So Ramsey, can you tell us a little bit first about what your film is about and how you came to make it?
So What Happened in Vegas is the true story of about how I was literally beaten up by the police while I was on vacation in Vegas. What happened was, rewinding, you know, a little over 3 years, I'd actually gone to Vegas for vacation, and my friend Rhett Nielsen and I were just walking through a parking lot, and we'd had a great night, actually, and we were just walking to the parking lot on our way home, and I happened to see four police officers with this guy in custody, and I didn't know who this guy was. I didn't know what he'd done to get arrested, but he was kind of bent over the front of a police car, and he had handcuffs on, and they were kind of tugging on his handcuffs and making him scream. I don't know if they were cutting off his circulation, but they were kind of like tugging, and they kept, so you had four police officers around kind of torturing this guy and telling him that, you know, does your mama know she raised an F up? That's what they kept saying. Does your mama know she raised an F up, son? Does your mom know that? Well, they're tugging on his cuffs and the guy's screaming in this parking lot. And what was interesting is my friend who I was with, Rhett Nielsen, he was actually a former videographer for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department SWAT team. So he'd actually been on many, many SWAT raids where he'd, you know, followed the Las Vegas SWAT team into raids and actually, like, videotaped them. So he'd seen hundreds of situations with the police and videotaped them. And he just turned to me and looked at me and goes, I've never seen anything quite like this. This is wrong. I mean, these officers, it seemed like they were just kind of drawing out the situation and kind of enjoying torturing this guy. And so Rhett and I just sat there and watched this, and it really went on and on and on. They're just, you know, kind of verbally just criticizing the guy, and he's screaming his head off. And I actually was pretty shocked by it. Rhett was shocked by it. So I actually called 911 and reported the incident. I said, hey, you guys got to get a sergeant or a lieutenant down here. You got four police officers. Instead of getting this guy in the police car and getting him down to the jail, which is their job, they're basically, you know, tugging on his handcuffs, making him scream, torturing him. You got to get a sergeant or, you know, a lieutenant down here because this is wrong. A couple minutes after that phone call to 911, which I have a copy of, I ended up getting beaten up and arrested by those same police officers. So that's how the movie starts off, is that story. And I was just incredibly shocked that they could do something like this and get away with it. And they actually, kind of, so when I got out of the Clark County Detention Center, the first thing I did was call up Internal Affairs and report this incident because it was outrageous. And what I discovered was that the video, this happened on a Sunday night, and there were video cameras in the parking lot, like pointed directly at us. There were multiple cameras, and they actually claimed that the cameras weren't working that night. That they literally said that, and I just said, I don't believe you. And they said, well, that's fine. I also picked up the police report full of things that just simply didn't happen, and because there's no video to corroborate that, they basically completely got away with this. And I reported them to Internal Affairs, officers Mark Bellinger, Kyle Frett, and Jared Casper is the name of the officers, and Cole Erskine is the guy who wrote the police report. And I basically said, the things on this police report are fiction, they didn't happen, and furthermore, it's rather suspicious that the video disappeared. And so I reported this to Internal Affairs, and they opened up an investigation, and ultimately they concluded that no wrongdoing had occurred. It's okay to beat up, arrest, and throw somebody in jail after just because they've called 911 to report these officers for police brutality. They didn't see anything wrong with that. I was just absolutely shocked. And I asked myself the question, you know, in a town where you can get beaten up, arrested, and thrown in jail just for making a phone call to report police brutality, what else has this force gotten away with? And so that's really kind of how the film began. And so I started looking into these other cases and found that the LVMPD routinely does this. There's many cases where video footage has gone missing. It's interesting, you know, video cameras just often don't work when they're around the cops, when it doesn't support their version of events. When it does support their version of events, the cameras always seem to be working. So that's very interesting. Yeah.
You have a background working in TV.
Right.
Can you tell us a bit about that? And is that why you had the idea to make a film, whereas perhaps, you know, an ordinary
right.
person wouldn't?
Well, no, that's an interesting question. I remember sitting there in handcuffs and just saying to them, this is wrong. This is completely wrong what happened. And I said, and I'm not going to forget about this. Like, you will be hearing from me. And you know, I'm gonna tell the truth on this. And so I was sitting there, you know, at 4-something a.m. in handcuffs saying to this. And they just kind of shrugged it off and said, yeah, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then ultimately they put me in the car and sent me down to the station. And so I actually spent 3 days in the Clark County Detention Center. And when I was sitting in that holding cell for 3 terrible days, I wasn't thinking about making a film. I was just thinking, whatever I need to do to tell the truth. And I just had no idea that the video footage would go. I had no experience with the LVMPD. I didn't know a police department could be this corrupt. But so ultimately, I remember I took a ride home after those 3 days I was released, and there was a cab driver who was giving me a ride home, and I told him what had happened, and he said, well, ultimately, it's going to take somebody telling your story and for somebody who's really kind of like fearless, like Rolling Stone, you know, some magazine to kind of like tell your story to expose this. And I said, yeah, maybe that's what I'll do. Maybe I'll, you know, contact the press. And then it kind of occurred to me, wait a minute, I can do that. I can make a film telling the truth about what these police officers did. And so that's how the movie began. And it was really once I dove down that rabbit hole and discovered these other wild cases of corruption, like the Eric Scott case and other shootings as well. It's incredible the lack of accountability the LVMPD has and how they just kind of step on the public that pays their salary and get away with it time and time and time again.
You feature 3 cases in the film. How did you come to feature those 3?
That's a good question. To me, those 3 cases were some of the most egregious cases of misconduct. The Eric Scott case is just incredibly, you know, you look at the facts of the case, and the facts of the case are Eric Scott was a superstar, basically. I mean, he graduated from West Point and had an MBA from Duke. Really handsome, good-looking guy who actually went into a Costco to get a water bottle and ended up dead.
One of the themes of the film is how the police department is manipulating the PR of these situations
right.
so that the people's characters are assassinated, and often, sadly, in these police killings, they are people where perhaps there is some sort of backstory that can be manipulated. They're people who are perhaps slightly more down on their luck. But in the case of Eric Scott, that stands out as being pretty clear that, you know, but they still manage to assassinate his character.
Yeah, what they do is they're ultimately looking, they kind of assess everything and go, okay, well, this was a handsome guy who made a lot of money, was really well educated, but where's there a kink in the armor? What can we latch onto? And all they could latch onto with Eric Scott was that he was on prescription medication because he tore out his back when he was in the Army jumping out of airplanes. So he was on painkillers. So even though this was a very accomplished and impressive human being, they saw that thing, they latched onto it, and they really did manage to convince the public that Eric Scott was on a lethal dose of painkillers when he was shot. See, and what that does is it
so like he was going crazy.
Yeah, it absolves the LVMPD of responsibility, and they know that. So that's what they do. They kind of assess the situation, they find anything they can latch onto, and they use that information to assassinate the person's character, therefore absolving them of responsibility. And so that what that does is it helps because that helps the public write them off. Oh, he was just a druggie, he was this, he was that, and then they will forgive the LVMPD and kind of put it on the victim. And they were actually fairly successful in doing that in the Eric Scott case. What is more evil than assassinating somebody's character after you've killed them for no reason? But this is a department that does this routinely. And my film kind of tells the truth about why they manipulate this, their motives for manipulating, and ultimately everything in Vegas comes down to money. Tourism. Tourism is what almost most people who work in Vegas are involved with the tourism business. You know, over 40 million visitors a year, billions of dollars. Police shootings and stories of police corruption, that's obviously bad for tourism, bad for business. So if you get if you can kind of manipulate the facts to put it on the victim, then and keep the stories out of the headlines, then you can keep the registers ringing. So my film kind of exposes how money plays a role in Vegas, and everything revolves around money.
I understand you felt you had to stay off the radar while making the film. I mean, I wanted to ask you what your specific fear was about, and also now that the film is going to be out there in the world, whether you do have a sense there may be some repercussions, perhaps legal or otherwise.
Yeah, that's the reason that I'm going to stay out of Vegas, is because, you know, having the experience I had where these officers beat me up just for reporting them and completely got away with it, that's how I feel. I would feel that's a possibility if I went back there, you know, is that whatever they chose to do to me, if they chose to do something to me, I feel that they would get away with it. They got away with it before. Why wouldn't they get away with it again? You know, unfortunately, there's this predisposition to always believe police officers. And the truth is that most of the time it's true. I mean, most police officers are good, but there's sometimes they're not. And there are a lot of bad apples on the LVMPD, and I just don't want to have anything to do with those bad apples, because in Vegas, those bad apples almost always get away with it.
I wanted to ask you, coming from Britain originally, I'm a dual citizen now, it's quite strange to me that law enforcement officials are elected rather than it be a career. Do you think that's part of the problem?
Absolutely. If you look at the sheriffs who've been elected in Vegas, invariably they're the people who raise the most money. So it doesn't have anything to do with integrity or performance. It's who can raise the most money. And as we know, raising money comes with compromises. So obviously, if the big money buys the election, that means you have to, hey, if I gave you a lot of money to help you get elected, I have to look out for your interests. So the big money gets, if they can put the right guy in there, then they can spin things the way they needed to be spun and keep the registers ringing for the people who got them elected.
Well, that's a reflection of the wider political environment
right.
In the U.S., I think, also.
Yeah.
But included in the film are more positive elements of the power of community policing and trying to focus on increasing what works rather than focusing on just managing the bad. Was it important to you to also present an antidote to the problems?
Absolutely. I mean, you don't want to just sit there and whine. Like, let's show the solution. And, I mean, the truth is, I was just kind of following the story as it went along, and what happened was, because my friend, Rhett Nielsen, who was a former LVMPD SWAT videographer, the guy that he worked with was Larry Burns, who was in charge of the LVMPD SWAT team, and it was actually Larry's idea to have cameras following on the SWAT raids. And he did that because he felt confident that his team was doing things right and on the up and up, and that that he had nothing to hide, and so there was no reason not to do that. And so Rhett kept telling me about this guy, Larry Burns, this incredible SWAT commander, Larry Burns. Larry Burns is a great cop. You got to talk to him. And honestly, I kind of got like tired of hearing about this great cop, but then I met him, and I was blown away by his incredible charisma and his true desire to do good. I felt a real sense of that Larry Burns was a man who got in law enforcement because he believed he could help people and that he had unshakable integrity. And as I talked to other officers, I realized that he's incredibly popular and renowned for doing the right thing. And that's why when he decided to run for sheriff, they took a poll and literally 96% of the officers in this poll wanted Larry Burns to be sheriff. But his reputation for integrity and doing the right thing was well known. I mean, this is one of the most famous cops in all of Las Vegas. And so as I came to know Larry, it kind of restored my faith in, you know, that there can be good cops. And through Larry, I met a lot of good cops like Dennis Flynn and Lori Bish. And these were good cops who saw what was going on in the department was wrong, and they wanted to change it. And Larry, they saw him as the guy to change it. So I got on board with that. I said, you know, so Larry and I became friends. And I started kind of following him around and talking to people that he'd helped. And I watched how he'd actually, you know, when he was in charge of the Bolden Area Command, he actually brought crime down by forming a bond with the community. And the idea there is if you talk to the shop owners in the community and make friends with them and actually form a bond with law enforcement, that when something wrong is going on, these people will actually talk to you, rather than the situation you have in Vegas right now where they have saturation teams and it's kind of an us versus them. And so what happens is there's a real hostility towards police in Vegas when you have that approach. And so when people know about something, they won't call the cops because they rightly recognize that, you know, some of these cops do not have the citizens' best interests in mind, you know?
Finally, one of my areas of interest is how art can help people consider and process difficult issues, both those people making the art and people experiencing it. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the power of art to do that.
I think art is incredibly powerful to move people and change action. And actually, Doug Blush, who became involved with our project, I wanted to get Doug involved because I saw one of the best films I've ever seen was a film that Doug Blush edited called The Invisible War about rape in the military. I'll never forget watching that film for the first time and just my jaw dropping. And I learned a bunch of things. I had no idea that this was a problem that nobody knew about. And after the impact of that film really put that on the radar, that rape in the military is a problem. And so I actually knew somebody who knew Doug Blush, and I reached out, and we were able to get Doug Blush involved. And so to have the editor of The Invisible War on our team, like kind of consulting with us and telling us what, you know, was a huge asset. And so I was thrilled to have Doug Blush on board, and he did a great job for us, you know.
Well, it's a wonderful film. I hope a lot of people see it. Thank you for making it, and thank you for talking.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my arts guests this week from the film What Happened in Vegas, which had its world premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival. We're going to go to a break now, but I'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Something
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
I'm Casey, and I'm the second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. This week I'm featuring the film What Happened in Vegas, a documentary about police corruption and brutality, which had its world premiere recently at the Cinequest Film Festival. And before the break, we heard from Ramsey Dennison, the director, producer, and editor of the film. If you just joined us, Ramsey decided to make the film after he witnessed police brutality in Vegas, called 911 to report it, and then was beaten up and arrested himself for doing so. He covers this story in the film, as well as several cases in Vegas, including the police killing of an unarmed man, Eric Scott, as he left Costco. My next guest, Bill Scott, is the father of this young man and is featured in the film. I talked to Bill at the Cinequest Film Festival in the foyer of the iconic California Theatre. I'm here with Bill Scott, who is featured in the film What Happened in Vegas. Very sadly, his son is one of the victims portrayed in the film. So perhaps first, Bill, I'd just like to say I'm terribly sorry for your loss. It must be a dreadful, dreadful situation. But perhaps you could just tell listeners your son's story.
Sure. My son is Eric Scott, and he lived in Las Vegas at the time, 2010, when he was killed. And he was a pacemaker sales rep for Boston Scientific. He routinely carried a firearm. He legally did that. He had a concealed carry permit. And on this particular Saturday in July of 2010, he and his girlfriend were in a Costco store in Summerlin area of Las Vegas. And they were shopping for things because they were basically setting up house together. They were looking forward to getting married, etc. So while they were in Costco, Eric squatted on the floor to fit check three water bottles into a soft-sided cooler for his girlfriend. He was a real health nut, and he wanted her to use stainless steel bottles, not plastic. So when he was doing that, his T-shirt rode up and his concealed carry weapon, which he carried inside the belt of his pants right behind his right hip, became exposed. Somebody saw it, reported it to a Costco undercover security guy, Shay Lyerly. And one thing led to another. Somebody talked to him. There was no animosity between Eric and the Costco manager. Manager said, he'll be out of here before long, no problem. Why did they do that in the first place? Because Costco supposedly has a no-gun policy in their store. However, they don't post the signs outside. They don't put it on the application form that Eric had filled out that day. One thing led to another, and this security guy, against company policy, called the cops. And he started ratcheting up and basically lying. He said, there's a guy in the store who is carrying a gun, and he's acting, quote, erratic. We later found out that there was another guy in the store, also with a female, that had caused some kind of a disturbance at the pharmacy. And they, their bill, everything was somewhat similar. So was it a mistake or was it intentional after the fact? We don't know. But there was somebody acting crazy. It was not Eric. Okay. But the guy called the cops, and they basically amped it up such that it sounded like this guy was a whacked out crazy guy in the store, barricaded, had a weapon. So the cops rolled in with 15 cop cars, helicopter, etc. And they'd, you know, had suggested evacuating the store without telling the customers what was going on. So Eric and his girlfriend calmly walked out with the crowd, and Eric was a little bit ahead of his girlfriend. He walked past a cop, William Mosier, who was stationed at the door. Very heavy-set guy. And he was sweating crazy. Witnesses said that he was holding his .45 firearm in two hands and shaking like the proverbial leaf. But Eric walked past him. Shay Lyerly, the Costco undercover guy, pointed at Eric, made eye contact with the cop, and said, "That's him." The cop panicked, and he turned 180 degrees, started shouting at Eric. He gave three conflicting commands and shot Eric within 2 seconds. Eric only had time to turn 180 degrees, face the cop, try to figure out what was going on, and then bam, he was shot in the heart. Second shot went through Eric's right leg. As my son looked at his girlfriend, his eyes basically said, "What just happened?" And then he fell. Two other cops stationed at the other door, not knowing why their partner had fired, opened up and put another 5 rounds in Eric's back after he was falling down and on the ground. So that's the basics of the story. Amazingly, this happened within a crowd of roughly 100 people that had just evacuated the store and were trying to stay in the shade.
So putting the public at risk as well.
Most definitely. If there was any good that came out of this, it was that Eric was such a powerfully built, very much in shape guy that he soaked up all 7 rounds. Well, not quite. Mosier's second round went through his thigh, and where it wound up, we don't know. But fortunately, it didn't hit anybody. And that, in a nutshell, is what happened. Now, the aftermath was, all the cameras were working, all the security cameras were working. However, they fed this one digital video recorder in the Costco security area. That video recorder was left in Costco's hands for 5 days. Normally, that never happens. The cops take it immediately as part of the evidence. They left it in their hands for 5 days. Costco claimed that they tried to, quote, recover the data. Now, wait a minute. They also said that because that DVR started acting up 2 days before, they had it shut off. So which is it? Was it turned off at the time, or was it running but it had a problem? So there were a lot of inconsistencies right away. The bottom line is that DVR, the cops finally picked it up 5 days later. They engaged the Secret Service, U.S. Secret Service, to do forensics analysis of it. They found that 96% of the data on that DVR were recoverable. Only 4% were not. It just happened to be the time that Eric was shot and killed outside. So, and why was that data unrecoverable? Because, because the platters, that the recording platters in that digital video recorder were, quote, physically damaged somehow. So all of this adds up to what is going on. I came out of the flight test community where everybody tells the truth or somebody gets hurt. From the very moment I was notified by my other son that Eric had been shot and killed in Las Vegas, it was clear that there was a narrative underway. The first thing that my son said in response to my question, "What happened?" They said, or Kevin said, he was told by the people that called him that Eric was in a Costco acting crazy, waving 3 guns around. And of course, I'm in shock. I said, "What in the world is he doing?" Kevin was cool enough to say, "Dad, think about it. How do you wave 3 guns with 2 hands?" So the cover-up started immediately, and it progressively got worse.
I mean, obviously, the cover-up aspect and the corruption are extremely disturbing, especially with people who have so much power. But there also seems an issue to me about how the police are interacting with the public on a larger scale. And I've covered this on my show somewhat, what is the role of police in society. And also, I did a show on can restraint be as courageous as action. There was a protocol by the British Army during in the Middle East called Courageous Restraint, and it was really all about no collateral damage, so that you had to be absolutely 100% sure before any snipers or anything shot anyone that they were an insurgent, that they weren't anybody else. It wasn't a kind of shoot first, find out later, and that's in a war situation. So it seems to me that we have a bit of a situation in the, you know, these things that come to light, where it is just sort of that the protection of the police is put above like everything. It, you know, it doesn't matter. It is just a sort of shoot first and we'll find out what actually the situation was later. And one of the things I've wondered is about the training of police. You know, they're put in often, admittedly, difficult situations with weapons, with very, very minimal training. I mean, you don't have to have a degree, I understand, in many states. It's a relatively short training that mainly focuses on the law and physical aspects. I'm just wondering whether that's an area that you feel has impacted your terrible case here, apart from the corruption, which obviously that needs to be dealt with, but also in how the police are behaving because of how they're, or their lack of training, basically, to deal with these high tension. You said the police officer was sweating and, you know, obviously scared.
Yes, that's a perfect point. And training is a significant factor. In December of 2014, the Atlantic magazine, the online version, Atlantic.com, had an outstanding story about police training. And they came up with any number of factors that are affecting what is happening today. And what is happening today is that police officers nationwide in the U.S. are killing an average of 3 people per day every day of the year. So in 2016, they killed 1,153 people. Since 9/11, 2001, the cops have killed at least 3 times as many people as we lost on that modern day of infamy. But the Atlantic article pointed out several things about the training, and it has shifted dramatically in the last 15, 20 years as terrorism and drug cartels have come on the scene. So now the cops are trained in the academies that officer safety is paramount. It comes first. So the whole idea, or the these cadets are trained over and over, do what you have to do to go home safely at night.
Now, the interesting thing is, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, being a police officer is actually about, I think it's 15th as the most dangerous job. You know, being a taxi driver, working in the fish industry, construction, are all more dangerous in the regard of actually being injured or killed, is my understanding. So do you think that also is contributing, that they're pushing this idea of extreme threat? I mean, I know police officers do go into difficult situations, but do you think their perception of threat is magnified, and that is part of the issue too?
Yes, that's part of training, because these new officers are taught that everybody they come in contact with out there is a potential threat. So it does develop this us versus them culture. But then you take it a step further, and you find that not only is the mentality different, but they are trained, and it's beat into them almost on a daily basis that you go ahead and shoot first, save, make sure you're safe, and let God sort the good from the bad. There is a saying they learn at the police academy, much better be tried by 12 than carried by 6. So they enter the field with that mentality. Now, yes, they often do come into tough situations. But to your point about not ranking even in the top 10 most dangerous jobs, farming is far more dangerous than being a cop. An oil rig, roughneck, my old field, test pilot, far more dangerous. But what they're not trained is what people in my old field, aviation, are trained, is that you have to take time to think. And when you're in a critical situation, if you don't do the right thing, things are going to go very bad. I had to jump out of an airplane that we were testing. From the time that we saw we were in serious trouble, and I announced what I was seeing, and the captain of the airplane gave the bailout order, until I was outside was less than 15 seconds. Co-pilot right behind me, barely got a chute, broke his leg in three places when he hit the ground. The captain came out, did not have time for a chute, and he was killed. I understand what the cops are up against. Time is critical at times, but you have to think. You have to do the right thing. A lot of that is training, so that you do things automatically. So, yes, I appreciate how dangerous cops jobs are. But let me give you one set of statistics that came out of that Atlantic article. If you look at all the interactions between the public and police officers, and it works out to be on the order of 63 million engagements a year, okay. And a few years ago, cops, about 51 cops were killed in what they call lethal actions, you know, as opposed to car wrecks. That's where most of them were killed. But felonious actions where the cop was killed. Okay, you put all those things together and you find out that a cop, whenever he engages with somebody, has a 0.08 of a percent chance of being harmed or killed. Yeah. Okay, the odds are very much with the cop. Yeah. So there is not this absolute wired to shoot thing necessary. It just is not. The officer that killed my son, William Mosier, was one of about 600 that were hired in the mid-2000s by Las Vegas Police Department. Why? Because Vegas was growing very, very fast. And his name was William Mosier. He shot and killed two people, including my son, within his first 5 years on the force. He said under oath that he had pulled his weapon over 100 times during that period. Something's wrong here. Most cops go in full career and they can count the number of times on one hand or two hands that they pulled their weapon, let alone shoot and kill somebody, okay? So something is drastically different. I interviewed for my new book a guy named Randy Titus. He's on the record as being the training officer, and he was known as the super training officer for the police academy there in Las Vegas. And he remembered Mosier. He tried to get him washed out, kicked out. And he gave me some great quotes about what this guy was like. Said he couldn't think under stress. He tended to panic. He just was not police officer material. And yet he's on the force still today. He's killed two people. And he lied under oath, at least in my son's case. And the problem is the cops get away with doing exactly this because we, the people, we do not insist on the proper protocols to stop this stuff. But we have to, because it's only going to be a matter of time until people say, cops are not curing this problem themselves, Department of Justice is not. What happens when people start taking up taking these things into their own hands? We've seen a few whacked out cases where five officers were shot and killed in Dallas, two in Baton Rouge, two in Las Vegas a few years ago. What happens if the average American takes up arms and starts hunting cops? We don't want to go there. We've got to stop this problem now.
Yeah. Would you say that, apart from justice for your son, is one of the main reasons that you wanted to get involved with the film?
I wanted to get involved with Ramsey's film because, first of all, he came to me. He heard about my son's case and said, this is one of the more egregious cases that happened in Las Vegas. But my problem was, I heard the cops' narrative. I knew how false it was. It could be proven how false it was. But we had two lawsuits, and neither one of them ever came to trial for a number of very good reasons that I do explain in both of these books. However, there is a predisposition to believe the cops. Yes. But this film was a way of telling this story, telling it truthfully in a very condensed fashion. Yes, it was one of three different cases that Ramsey featured, but I think he did an outstanding job of capsulizing what happened. Now, my first book, called The Permit, was a fiction book with the real story wrapped around it. People say, well, why'd you do it as fiction? We had legal action underway at the time. My lawyer said, no, you cannot do the nonfiction version. But all that has passed. So then with two other great co-authors, both of whom are former police officers, we have now written a new nonfiction book that tells the details. So it fills in the gaps of what Ramsey's movie doesn't tell, if you will. And it's called License to Kill, The Murder of Eric Scott. And we hope it'll be out within a year.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I hope listeners will check out the film and your first book and the new book when it comes out. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Thank you again there to my guest, Bill Scott, from the film What Happened in Vegas. We're going to go to a break now, but I'll be back with more conversations after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. This week I'm featuring guests from What Happened in Vegas, a shocking and heartbreaking documentary about three murder cases in Vegas where victims were shot by the police. My last guest is Doug Blush, producer and editorial supervisor for the film. I'm talking to Doug Blush now from What Happened in Vegas. He was producer and editorial supervisor. Doug, you've got a great body of work. You've worked on the documentaries The Invisible War and The Hunting Ground, both films which deal with an entrenched elite protecting its own, like the situation in What Happened in Vegas. As a filmmaker, what attracts you to working on these types of projects?
Well, it was so interesting when I first was contacted by Ramsey because he was also watching those films and being influenced by them. And when he brought me the film, I a lot of people come to me with rough cuts of projects in progress, and some of them deal with justice issues or institutional problems. And I see a lot of them, and many of them are like, oh, they're interesting, but they don't really have a story, or they're not that well established. And when I was watching Ramsey's film, I saw it at a rough stage, but in the middle of it, I saw such a dedicated sense of pursuing a core problem that really was profound, and that Ramsey was doing it because he was involved directly. He had, as I say, he had skin in the game. He actually was a victim of this same police force. And the fact that he didn't just make it about his particular journey, he expanded it into the many stories that he began to find, which is the hallmark of good journalism. You know, you track the leads that you find. As I watched the film, I went more and more into it, and I said, oh, this is really a deep probe into a serious unknown situation, and it takes an entire systemic police force issue in a city and makes it something that we can expand into the whole country and the issues we're having all over the country. So I was really excited to jump in and try to help him steer the film to get it to festivals and to get it in the place where it could be seen by a lot of other people. Yeah.
And when you're making a documentary film, you know, dealing with a lot of facts, you need, obviously, to keep your audience engaged. I'm wondering how you approach that. Is it all in the editing? Is there a lot of storyboarding in advance? What would you say is important, having worked on some films that have done it really well?
Well, the real thrill of documentary is that we don't really have a script. You know, we don't go out with a script. In fact, anything that has a script, I'm quite suspicious of, because it means that the filmmakers have made up their mind before they go film. And with documentary, it's all in discovery. It's almost like it's almost like trial lawyering. You're in discovery mode, and what you find out there will shape your story. So in that sense, editing is everything in a documentary. You're writing the film in the edit room, and that's why I am, of all the things I do, directing and producing and everything else, I am an editor first, because I feel like editing in documentary is the most powerful expression of what the story is ultimately going to be, what you do and don't show, because you have thousands, sometimes thousands of hours of material. You can't show it all. You have to make your case in a really coherent and a really entertaining and cinematic way. And by doing that with Ramsey, we were able to find the core things that really made the film pop. And I think that by tracking the story as he went along, he sort of went down the rabbit hole that many people do when they pursue a documentary. You find a story that leads to another story, and that leads to, wow, another story, and oh, look at this footage we just got in. There's a late breaking piece of footage in the film that he showed me after many cuts had already been done, and it was like, this is even more amazing. We're going even deeper. So yeah, it's exciting because you don't know what's going to happen. It's not like a narrative film. It's not like La La Land, where there's a script and the actors are great and you get into post and you've got everything done. Yeah. You find it in the editing, and sometimes you get surprises at the last minute. It happens a lot.
Yeah. Now, with the film you worked on, The Invisible War, there some really important changes came about from that, with how the military deals with sexual assault. What would be your hopes for this film, and what might happen from it?
Well, with Invisible War, what we're all so proud of, and what you know, the director Kirby Dick and the producer Amy Ziering were able to do, is get Washington to pay attention and get you know, legal action instigated, and to get organizations really fired up to pursue these things. We're very proud that we were the inspiration for real legislation, both stuff that passed and stuff that is pending and will come back again. And we've also been a part of a giant coalition of activists and people who, you know, veterans who served and dealt with these issues and are now together and bonded because of the film, because of their own interactions. And because of that, we've got a national movement now. So when we work on films like this, we want to create a national movement. We want to create awareness to the point where, hey, my city's having this problem too. This film inspired me to go take a look at this. So if there are five other documentaries that come off of this documentary, that would be fantastic. If there was an investigation at the state or the national level in police practices, if there was something that we could see in Las Vegas, in Nevada, in the West in general, everywhere that comes off this film, we win, we succeed. And that's why this filmmaking is so exciting, because we're taking this as direct democracy. We're saying, here's a problem, we're citizens who are concerned, we're calling it out.
One of the things I liked about the film, I spoke to Ramsey about, is that it did focus on some possible antidotes. Yes. It did focus on the positive of community policing, and there's a protocol called Appreciative Inquiry, which I'm a big fan of, which is about focusing on what works and trying to do more of that rather than looking at the problems and trying to fix those. And one of the great examples in the film was given about police officers. I think they had to make it, was it 180? Was it a day or interaction? Maybe not a day, but frequent interactions with the public for no bad reason, but just to, you know, get to know people. And so was it important, do you think, to include some positive antidotes in the film?
Absolutely. The best thing that a documentary can do, because there are a lot of films that just define the problem. And those are great because you get aware of the problem, maybe you are upset about the problem and you want to go take action. But films that offer solutions, we found, are much more effective because you can't just leave the problem there. People will just feel so overwhelmed. And there are films that people walk out going, oh, there's no hope, I don't have any. They go home, they go to bed.
Yeah.
And instead, what we want to do is have people say, I just saw some solutions to this. I'm going to call my local representative. I'm going to call my senator. I'm going to call the local school board, whatever. Yeah. And I'm going to say, I saw a solution. Let's try this. Let's work on this together. And the great part about what happened in Vegas is the second half of the movie features a story of somebody who is putting out and has the authority to say, here's the way to really make it work. And he has statistical evidence that his way worked, you know, and when he runs for sheriff, when we have the sheriff election story, it's both difficult because of, and I won't say too much, but the bottom line is he ran on a platform that offers solutions, and those solutions are still sitting there.
Yeah.
They're still waiting. And I think that if you offer those solutions, people will not get depressed. They won't say, what can you do? How can you fight City Hall? We don't want to fight City Hall. We want to work with City Hall to make real solutions. Find the people who are allies and say, we have things that can work. Let's work together on this stuff.
Yeah. Obviously, the film's just had its world premiere. It's doing the round of festivals, which films always do, which sometimes the public doesn't necessarily realize that. But if people listening would like to follow and support the film, what's the best way to do that? Is there a website or?
Well, we suddenly have exploded on social media, so we have a Facebook page. Just look for What Happened in Vegas. We have a Twitter feed.
Okay.
I think there's an Instagram coming. We're going to have a blog. We have a website. Anything you want to know, especially about other organizations and other stories in the film that you can expand on by going to the website and the Facebook page, those will be available. And we'll welcome also people sending their stories. That's really important. If people have stories like this, we want to know about it. We want to create a community that's much bigger than the film.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking to me,
thanks
Doug.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Thank you again very much to all my guests from the film What Happened in Vegas that had its world premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival. If you liked this show, then please go to the website. It's a question of balance.com. You'll find the podcast there and you can tell all your friends about it. And remember to check out the topics and the arts guests. Thanks for listening. Join me again next time.